We check our phones now more than ever, an average of 52 times a day. We're talking about one tech writer's breakup with his phone here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There's tension here, right? Because the work world may need you online, monitoring and responding to emails and messages at all hours of the day and weekend. But studies tell us again and again that too much tech is bad for our mental health. Do you feel like you're too attached to your phone? Have you tried to change that? And was it harder or easier than you thought it would be? And speaking of phones, it's not lost on us. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Roos is a tech columnist for the New York Times. The New York Times Magazine, his article about smartphone rehab is called Do Not Disturb, How I Ditched My Phone and Unbroke My Brain. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you say you've always loved your phone ever since you got a phone. What made you want to change how much you use your smartphone? Because after all, you write about tech for a living.
Absolutely. And I do love my phone. I love technology. I'm not a Luddite or a technology hater. But sometime last year, I felt myself changing. I felt I couldn't read books anymore. I couldn't really watch full-length movies. It was hard for me to have long conversations with people. I was just twitchy and I had no attention span and I was just anxious all the time about my phone. So I decided I had to do something about it. So I contacted a woman who had written a book about sort of detaching yourself from your phone, and I begged her to be my phone rehab coach.
So you were just really having some issues, like waiting for the chip reader at a store to accept your credit card. You would glance at your phone. What was that experience like for you, especially at the beginning when you realized that something had been changing inside of you?
The first couple days were rough. I mean, this is withdrawal, right? Like, this is an actual sort of neurochemical process that you have to go through, because your phones are designed to be addictive. They're not that way by accident. So the first couple of days were just spent noticing my own habits, when I reach for my phone and why. And sometimes it's boredom. Sometimes I'm just waiting. I'm trying to kill time while I'm waiting for the subway, or, you know, waiting for a friend to show up for lunch. And it's in those moments where the phone just kind of steps in as this easy solution. And so this process, this 30-day period that I went through, was trying to sort of reverse those habits and replace them with healthier ones.
So as you trained yourself to not compulsively check your phone and you eventually got better at it, how hard was to get better at not being on your phone so much?
It was pretty hard. I mean, the first week was the hardest, and then it got progressively easier. But I did set my phone up for success, and part of the program that I was on was, you know, rearranging the apps on your phone and putting a rubber band around my phone so that it makes it a little bit harder to use. One of the biggest changes was actually where you keep your phone. Experts say that keeping your phone in your bedroom is one of the worst things you can do for your sleep and your phone use. So if any of your listeners charge their phones in the bedrooms, you got to get it out of your bedroom. That's like step number one.
Well, you even bought something. You bought like a lockbox or something.
I'm an extreme case. So I bought a little mini safe on Amazon, and I started keeping my phone in there at night.
We're talking about smartphone detox with Kevin Roos. He's a tech columnist for the New York Times and the New York Times Magazine. Have you ever tried to use your phone or other devices less? What was that process like? Call in with your phone this time. Connect with us at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So your project to deal with your smartphone addiction, and you use the word addiction, you know, hesitantly, by the way, it was personal. You come face to face with your own fears of boredom and stillness, of having to look around. But you also said that this addiction isn't just an issue of personal responsibility. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, I was sort of hesitant to describe this as an addiction because it's not purely our fault that this is happening. And I don't want people to blame purely themselves if they feel like they have an unhealthy habit with their smartphone. Because on the other side of the screen, what you don't see is the thousands of engineers in Silicon Valley trying very, very hard to get you to spend more time on your phone. And these are some of the smartest people in the world in the computer industry. And they're working at these companies like Facebook and Twitter, and they are very, very good at hooking you to your phone. So it's not just that we need change on the individual user side. We also need for these companies to start letting us have our brains back, because they're a big part of why we can't read books or watch movies anymore.
What would that look like? What could these tech companies do to ensure that people aren't addicted to their phones?
Well, they've started doing a little bit. So Apple, you know, and Google both now offer sort of device level controls for screen time. So your iPhone can, you know, limit you to 1 hour a day of social networking or something like that. But we also, I think, could use some changes within these apps. Like maybe they don't need to notify you every time someone, you know, every time it's someone's birthday, or every time someone, you know, like posts in a group that you're in. They really do take advantage of our cognitive weaknesses to get us to spend more time on their apps.
Kevin, I'm wondering, how is this going for you? I mean, 30 days is one thing, but where do things stand now with your phone?
It's actually been pretty easy. I haven't felt a real pull back to it. And I think it's because I've gotten a lot out of this. I mean, it's not just that I use my phone less. It's that I'm doing all of these things that I really missed, like reading and watching movies and going for walks outside and really noticing my surroundings. All the stuff that I hadn't realized I had kind of given up for a few years.
So for people who might want to work on this themselves, can you give them a step forward? Like, where should they start? And, you know, what was your step-by-step process like?
Well, I would recommend that they get my phone coach's book. Her name's Catherine Price. The book's called How to Break Up with Your Phone. It has the whole 30-day plan in there. But I really think it's important that they know that there's a difference that between these sort of life hacks that people will use, these kind of one-off tips and things like that, and a real program that gets to, why do you want to do this? What are you trying to make more room for in your life? What do you like about your phone? What don't you like about your phone? It's really about going at the root cause of this addiction rather than just kind of treating the symptoms.
I'm wondering, did you feel like you had more time in your life after you had made these sweeping changes?
Absolutely. I read like a dozen books during this month. I did a lot of things on my to-do list. I spent, you know, my wife was very happy with this. You know, she saw more of me. So this really improved my life in a ton of ways. And it wasn't just about the phone. It was about all the things I was missing by being on my phone.
And looking around a little bit more, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Roos is a tech columnist for the New York Times and the New York Times Magazine. And his article about smartphone rehab is called Do Not Disturb: How I Ditched My Phone and Unbroke My Brain. Coming up, we look at last week's failed summit with North Korea and what it means for U.S. foreign policy and the ripple effect here in Wisconsin. Stay with us for that conversation here on the Ideas Network. About what happens now with North Korea after last week's failed summit. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un parted ways last week without even a final handshake for the cameras. No getting rid of a weapons cache, no deal on sanctions. We're going to take a closer look at what happened and what it means in foreign policy circles. Do you see this moment as a failure or success? And why? What chain reaction do you see this having on trade and tariffs? We're at 800-642-1234. Lisa Collins is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She studies U.S.-Korean relations, nuclear proliferation, human rights and refugee law, Northeast Asian security and more. Lisa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me again on the program.
So tell us, what was the offer on the table here during the summit? What was the goal?
So I think the goal on the United States side was to, again, have North Korea completely dismantle its nuclear weapons program. And there was, according to reports, that final offer on the table. But the North Koreans wanted full lifting of sanctions, and that was not something that was acceptable to the United States side.
So wanted full lifting of sanctions. Three presidents have tried this type of offer, a quarter century of work here. Why did President Trump think this time it might be different?
Well, that's a very good question. I think perhaps he was depending a lot on his personal relationship with Kim Jong-un. He before the summit, he said that they were friends and they had a good special relationship. And I think he was counting on that in part to convince Kim Jong-un that, that the United States was dependable and he could be trusted, and that the United States would follow through with the promises. Before, it's been hard because North Koreans have had a hard time trusting the United States fully. And I still think that they don't completely trust us.
Is it sanctions the reason why North Korea's supreme leader came to the table here for this summer, for the summit?
Well, I think it's a combination of different things. I think it's in part the sanctions, probably in part the threat that happened at the end of 2017 that the United States would strike North Korea militarily and undermine the regime, I think. And then a combination of other pressures from China and perhaps other countries in the region led up to North Korea coming back to the table. But sanctions were certainly a big part of it.
So how far did we get into this summit? And what did we take away on the back end of it? Did we move the needle at all between these two countries?
So I think that if the working-level talks continue beyond Hanoi, I think we can say that there was some progress made, because previous to this, there hadn't really been any significant communication channel between the North Koreans and the United States, at least one that had lasted beyond a couple months. And so if that happens after this summit, even though it's a failure, if the communication continues at the working level and if there's more progress made between the United States and North Korea on what actual denuclearization would look like and what the United States would give in return for that, then I think that could be considered some progress. But on the other hand, if this completely falls apart, then I'm afraid that Hanoi would have been seen as a big failure.
There have been talks that North Korea has promised not to resume weapons testing, and the U.S. is not going to do military exercises with South Korea. Are these two things true? And did this come from this summit?
So North Korea has promised, according to what was said at the Hanoi summit, that they won't continue testing their nuclear weapons and their ballistic missiles, at least in the short term. And then the United States, I think, has reportedly said that there won't be military exercises this coming spring, which happen every year around this time. But I don't know if that's a fair trade. Our military exercises are regular. They're necessary to keep our military forces prepared for any type of attack from North Korea and to keep them ready just generally for deterring North Korea. And I think that in the case of North Korea, the ballistic missile weapons tests that they had undertaken were not allowed under international law. So I don't know if it's a fair trade we can say is happening, but this is something that I think they've temporarily decided they are going to give for that. But I think going forward, it's a question of whether or not that's something that we want to continue. Do we want to continue to trade the exercises just for a freeze in North Korea's testing? That's something that's going to have to be decided by the administration.
We're talking with Lisa Collins. She's a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, talking about last week's meeting between the leaders of North Korea and the U.S. What struck you most about the meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week? Would you consider the meeting a failure or success? We're at 800-642-1234. Lisa, let's look a little bit here at sanctions. Afterward, in a news conference, North Korean officials offered a different explanation for why the talks broke down. They said that they had proposed only a partial removal of UN sanctions, 5 out of a total of 11, and that they would have permanently disabled its main nuclear complex in exchange for that. So what do we know about sanctions and what was asked for and what, you know, where they were in the negotiation of these sanctions?
So if you look at the United Nations Security Council resolutions that North Korea had asked to be lifted from 2016 and 2017, not only did they cover the ballistic missile and nuclear weapons development part of their program, but it also covered the export of main North Korean sources of funding, such as seafood exports, mineral exports, rare earth mineral exports, and in some cases, coal and the energy supply. So those were cut off because it was seen as giving money to the North Korean regime through the earning of foreign currency abroad. And I think what the North Koreans really wanted were those things that were lifted that were hurting them and trying to cut off their foreign currency supply that ultimately inevitably feeds back to the nuclear weapons program in a lot of ways. So I think that the North Koreans are basically just asking for those things that they want to basically restart their economy because the sanctions are having a bite on their real economy.
Would lifting sanctions, would that mean an infusion of cash for North Korea? Would that make an impact on its economy in a big way?
Well, I mean, it's always difficult to figure out how the sanctions impact the North Korean economy exactly. It's not a real science. It's difficult to figure that out. But I think that they were asking for that because, obviously, it does hurt their economy. And I think it primarily hurts the economy of Pyongyang, which is where the elites live. Now, the rest of the North Korean people have figured out a way to live on their own. They've developed grassroots markets in other regions to help provide for the people and help provide food and basic necessities. But it's probably the elite level that's being more hurt by some of these economic sanctions than those people at the grassroots level.
South Korea, of course, was watching on the sidelines very closely, and South Korean officials hope the U.S. and North Korea keep talking. Why is South Korea wanting to see some sort of resolution here?
Well, I think the South Koreans obviously are very intent on forming a peace process in order to further bring North Korea into the international community. And the current South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, he wants very much to have this peace process become his presidential legacy. And I think the South Koreans also would like, in the end, to get rid of the North Korean threat. And I think that's part of the reason why they've been so intent on engaging the North Koreans and trying to bring them into the world community by first dismantling their nuclear weapons program.
When we look at the way this summit ended so abruptly, no agreements made, what does this tell you about the difficulty of solving the issues facing the Korean Peninsula?
I think it just shows you how difficult the whole process will be and is. It will take many, many years. Some experts predict that it could take up to 10 years for North Korea to completely dismantle its nuclear weapons program if it's being compliant and helpful in any type of negotiations process. But it's going to take much longer than probably just one presidential term in order to get North Korea to dismantle its program. And that just means there has to be regular talks at the working level because not everything can happen at the summit level between two different world leaders or at the presidential level. So I think we have to expect that there will be further working talks if the North Koreans agree to it going forward.
Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
Lisa Collins is a fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She studies U.S.-Korean relations, human rights, refugee law, nuclear proliferation. Our discussion about the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea continues here on the Ideas Network. We're putting current events into context, and you're part of this conversation. How should America work with North Korea? Are we on the right track, or do you prefer one of the strategies we've used in the past? You can call in at 800-642-1234. News is coming up next. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Looking at what the collapse of talks between the U.S. and North Korea means, and we're examining economic sanctions in particular, how they hit home. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The failed summit leaves an uncertain path for one of President Trump's signature foreign policy issues. North Korea refused to freeze all of its weapons programs. Are you happy with the way the president left the talks? Do you think he should have stuck it out? What is the trickle-down effect on trade and our established markets around cranberries and ginseng? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've called in David Fields to guide us. He's Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. He's author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've said that we'd know almost immediately if this summit were a failure, but that it would take longer to figure out the successes. What do you mean by that?
I think we would have known immediately if the summit was a failure, if it would have produced another agreement that was as vague as the one that was signed at Singapore last year. I think that would be a signal to us that President Trump's administration had not been willing to do the homework, had not been willing to do the legwork in advance to make sure that they could get something meaningful at this summit. But as it turns out, it looks like they didn't do their homework, but they also did not sign a meaningless deal. They chose to walk away instead, which I think was probably the best decision that they could have made under those circumstances. You see, for the last, I would say, 30 years, the United States has always chosen to treat the North Korean nuclear issue as a multilateral issue, because at a very fundamental level, North Korean nuclear weapons are not an American problem. They're a problem to the entire international community, and there's no obvious solution to this problem. So when there's no obvious solution to a problem, and when you know it's going to be a very, very long slog, I think the most important thing to do is stay on side with your allies. And Donald Trump had torn up that playbook. He had decided to go it alone, and I think that's quite dangerous. I think it's dangerous to get ahead of our allies in this way, and I hope now that he has walked away from the summit that hopefully this will be the end of the experiment in bilateral diplomacy, and he can come back, regroup with our allies, and approach North Korea as we have before. Unfortunately, the indications are that he's not going to do that.
Well, he had also really gloated, perhaps, about his relationship with North Korea's supreme leader. I mean, there are anecdotes of him coming, you know, showing people in the Oval Office the letters they had exchanged. What about the softer relationship, and does that edge any closer to some type of diplomatic agreement?
I mean, we really don't know, and it's very, very hard to apprise from the outside. I mean, he says they have this wonderful relationship. He says that they fell in love. He said that the letters that they exchanged are absolutely beautiful. But when they got together, they could not come to any sort of deal. Maybe that relationship is still intact. Maybe it runs deeper than we think. You know, maybe this is a Reagan-Gorbachev-type relationship. But from the outside right now, we simply do not have enough evidence to know whether that is the case. And I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb here to say that we can't always take the president's words at face value.
How does North Korea view its nuclear options and its nuclear cash? What's at stake for that country?
This is such an important point. And you'll often see North Korean nuclear weapons described as primarily defensive. And that is definitely true. Defense is a big part of the reason why North Korea has developed nuclear weapons. Certainly, if you have nuclear weapons, it makes you much less of a target for invasion. However, North Korean or nuclear weapons check a lot of boxes for the North Koreans. It's not all about defense. Ever since North Korea was founded in 1948, one of their primary foreign policy goals has been the reunification of the Korean Peninsula. They attempted that by force in 1950. And they were repulsed. They've not done it. They've not attempted it in that way again, but they have never given up that goal, at least officially. So there's a lot of disagreement right now about how serious they are about reunifying the peninsula at this moment. I think it's a really an open question and it's hard to assess, but there's no doubt that they've never dropped that goal. And if they ever wanted to try to reunify the Korean peninsula by force in the future, nuclear weapons would be incredibly valuable in that attempt. Now, another thing that the nuclear weapons do for North Korea is that they give the Kim regime some sort of accomplishment. If you look at the record of the Kim regime for the last 30 years, developing nuclear weapons is really the only concrete accomplishment they can point to. The Kim regime does not tell North Koreans, you live better lives today than you did in the 1970s because of us, because that's not true. North Koreans live much worse today than they did in the 1970s and the 1980s. And the Kim regime, the only accomplishment that it can point to under its rule at this time is that they have developed these nuclear weapons, that they have been able to thwart the United States in doing so, and this is a main argument for continuing their rule.
Talking with David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, we're looking at the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea. Did you make it a point to keep up with the news from the U.S.-North Korea summit in Hanoi? Why? What stuck out to you the most about the meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. David, a year ago, President Trump met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for their first summit. What was on the line the first time they met, and how did that differ with this summit that we just saw?
Well, I actually felt that the first summit was really overhyped in a number of ways as a historical meeting for the first time between a Korean leader and a sitting president of the United States. And Donald Trump and his administration tried to get out in front of that and really point to it as one of their accomplishments, when in fact this is something the North Koreans had been asking for years. They had always been happy to meet with American presidents. They're happy to meet with American leaders as high-ranking as possible because it adds to their legitimacy. It adds to they can show these photo ops to their people and say we're out there on the world stage. But also, they really want to make this issue a bilateral issue with the United States. They believe in a divide-and-conquer strategy, and they think it would be much easier to meet the United States than the entire international community. I think one of the ways that you can think of North Korean strategy at this point, this is my analysis, and I could be wrong about this, but I think one of the things that they're trying to do is they're trying to ask very hard questions of American foreign policy at a time when they think the answers might be to their benefit. So we're having a bit of a nationalist moment in the United States right now. The Trump administration is leaning on all of our allies in terms of trade, in terms of defense, asking them to do more, and they're really roughing up some relationships that have been intact the same way for 30 or 40 years. And I think from Pyongyang, you can look out at Washington and Seoul and you can see this environment. You can see a president for the first time in 30 years talking about withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea. And I think Kim Jong-un sees this as an opportunity. So one of the things that he can do is he can escalate tensions very, very, very high and then come to the negotiating table and see if he can't enter this somewhat chaotic environment and come out with a really good deal from the North Korean perspective. I think that is what he tried to do in Singapore. And it turns out both Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump had really misjudged each other. And this is a very, very scary thing when you think about the possibilities of conflict being higher now than they were before, when you think about the possibilities of a nuclear exchange being higher than they were before, and it seems like the two people at the helm are having a very hard time reading each other.
Well, let's look at this weekend. White House National Security Advisor John Bolton was talking on CBS's Face the Nation, and let's hear a bit from him.
Well, I don't consider the summit a failure. I consider it a success defined as the president protecting and advancing American national interest.
So did this summit advance U.S. interests? What is John Bolton pointing to there?
I think it advanced U.S. interests actually better than signing another very vague agreement would have. Now, it's going to take a long time to figure out whether the right thing was done here or not. And it's worrying that the announcement of the joint exercises with U.S. South Korea, that those are being put on hold.
Which are supposedly coming up soon, about this time of year.
Yeah, yeah. They were supposed to be going on right now.
Right now.
Now they're going on in a much more scaled down fashion. And this is something that the North Koreans have asked for a long time. And it's now something that Donald Trump is seeming to give him, which seems to tell me that he is still interested in the bilateral approach.
And Bolton has a history of breaking up international deals. Some experts say he played a role in the summit's failure. How could John Bolton have influenced this meeting, you know, even though he wasn't in the room?
I'm actually dubious that he did. I think we can see a clear line of causality here in Kim Jong-un actually thinking that he had maybe Donald Trump in a weaker position than he thought he did, and in Donald Trump really believing in his own charisma and his own personal connection more than he ought to have.
Former Vice President Joe Biden says the president was right to walk away from the summit. The Democrat has also criticized meetings with Kim Jong-un, calling him a thug. Should the U.S. be coming to the table with this country?
North Korea is clearly one of the most reprehensible regimes in the world. There's no doubt about that right now. Their treatment of their own people is absolutely appalling. North Korea essentially functions as a giant prison camp for most of its people. There's no freedom of movement in North Korea. So many of the North Koreans are locked in a daily struggle for their own subsistence. They're not good people. But at the same time, we really have no choice but to deal with them. There's no kinetic options for dealing with North Korea. There are no military options for dealing with North Korea. And that's been the case long before they had nuclear weapons. So we do need to deal with them, but we need to deal with them in a multilateral fashion.
Talking with David Fields, he's an associate director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see the U.S. approaching our relationship with North Korea? How do you think this all affects us here in the U.S. and specifically in Wisconsin? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the North Korea conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. Talking about North Korea and the ripple effect of a breakdown of talks last week in Hanoi. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. North Korea's leader vowed to meet again with President Trump to continue negotiations. The disagreement comes down to sanctions and disarmament. We're exploring what these foreign policy issues mean more broadly now for trade, tariffs, and the economy, and how this all hits home here in Wisconsin. You have a line at 800-642-1234. David Fields stays with us. He's an associate director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. David, let's look at these high-stake talks and bring them into the relevance of Wisconsin and the ripple effect here in Wisconsin. What is the impact of trade and tariffs and our industries here?
These talks and this whole conflict with North Korea is going on at a time when potentially all of our relationships with East Asia are being reshuffled. And this is an issue not just with Donald Trump. I mean, we're having a populist moment all across the United States. And it was especially disheartening to me during the last election to see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump attacking the TTP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal that was really going to address many of the trade imbalances between China and the United States it was going to deal for the first time in a meaningful way with intellectual property, something we are really good at and have an advantage at compared to these other countries. And these relationships that we have with East Asia, the United States in particular, but also Wisconsin, have been very, very beneficial to us. Now, the problem with trade, as any economist will tell you, is that the gains from trade are dispersed where the costs of trade are concentrated in just a few areas. So what's happened over the last decade is we've all benefited from trade, but there's a few places that have lost out. There's a few industries that have been hit very, very hard. And rather than reinvest some of those gains into helping out those places with trade adjustment assistance, our leaders have instead chosen to go a populist route. And they've chosen to try to pick on these relationships, to try to bully people into giving concessions, when in fact these could have been dealt with much more efficiently at the negotiating table and with a little trade adjustment assistance here and there. So I think, in a sense, these trade tensions are spurring on this crisis, and this crisis is going to make these trade tensions more and more difficult. Donald Trump is leaning on China for a better trade deal. At the same time, he's asking them for help with North Korea.
Nancy in Milwaukee called in to say, we keep talking about how President Trump walked away from an agreement with Kim Jong-un, but could we also deduce that maybe Mr. Kim walked away from President Trump?
I think that's exactly a possibility. This is one of the problems with conducting these negotiations in only a bilateral fashion with just the two leaders. When they come out and say different things, as they did, Donald Trump said that they wanted all sanctions released. The North Koreans said, no, we asked for partial sanctions release. We actually don't know who is telling the truth. We don't know who miscalculated here. And in fact, we really don't know why these negotiations happened in the first place, going all the way back to Singapore. Was it Donald Trump's fire and fury that brought the Koreans to the negotiating table in a new way? Or rather, was it the North Koreans that saw an opportunity with a president whose foreign policy has been somewhat erratic, and they thought that maybe they could get in here and take advantage of this reshuffle and get something out of it? So I think it's a very good question. Unfortunately, it's one that we don't know the answer to right at this moment.
How does the U.S. fit into North Korea's narrative right now? What character is America painted as in North Korea?
It's almost impossible to overestimate how negatively the United States is portrayed within North Korea. I mean, the anti-Americanism is so deep, and to our eyes, it's almost comical. I mean, if you would go and you would Google North Korean anti-American propaganda right now, you would see images that would be so outlandish that they would almost make you laugh. However, having spent a little bit of time in North Korea, I don't think that there's really anything funny about them, and I think it's difficult to appreciate the level of xenophobia that the Kims have cultivated in North Korea for about 40 years. I mean, they don't tell their people that under their leadership they live better. What they tell their people is there are nefarious foreigners out there, especially the Americans, just down on the other side of the 38th parallel. And the moment they get the chance, they are going to try to wipe out our country. They're going to try to wipe out our race. And it is our leadership, the visionary leadership of the Kim regime, that has developed nuclear weapons and that is ultimately going to keep all of us safe. Now, this sounds absolutely ridiculous to us, but North Koreans believe it. Not all of them, not 100%. But if they don't believe it, then they really don't know what to believe, because there's no counter narrative in North Korea against this story the regime is telling.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
David Fields is Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. He's written books about North Korea, and he joined us to talk about how the latest meeting between American leaders and North Korean officials fits into decades of tense relations across the world. Earlier, we talked with Lisa Collins at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. More than half of Wisconsin children live in a child care desert, meaning there's only one slot of licensed child care for every three kids. One big reason for this shortage of child care workers, as Phoebe Petrovic reports, that shortage has gotten much worse in the past several years.
A couple dozen children are toddling over the snow. They're bulky in coats and snow pants. One wants to play with a toy bulldozer. It's outdoor time at the St. Mary's Hospital Child Care Center in Madison. Christine Cook runs the center. She apologizes for her cluttered office and explains that lately she's been in the classrooms teaching.
Because I don't have anyone to hire.
Cook's had a position posted for 7 months. She could actually use two more teachers, but she can't even find the one. Cook's been director here for the last 3 years, and during that time, she's seen the number of child care workers plummet.
And I think now, well, now why are we not stable when I'm in this position, you know? And it's a sign of the times.
It's actually a sign of a good economy with low unemployment. Ruth Schmidt is the director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She says the state's workforce depends on child care.
And yet, it's one of these sort of odd scenarios where the stronger Wisconsin's economy is, unfortunately, the harder it is to keep people working in early childhood programs.
That's because benefits are poor and wages are low. In Wisconsin, the average child care worker earns $10.33 an hour. That's not enough to keep a family of four out of poverty. Yet child care teachers are, on average, more educated than the Wisconsin workforce. All over the state, child care directors are struggling to find and keep qualified teachers. About 3 out of 10 teachers leave their jobs each year, taking positions at public schools or retail chains like Quick Trip and Walmart. Jillian Clemens taught preschool for nearly a decade. Early on, she realized her salary wasn't sustainable.
Because I loved it and I was passionate about it, I at first was like, okay, I'll figure this out. I'll get a second job because this is what I want to do. This is who I am. This is literally a part of my person, right? Like I could feel it in my bones that I was going to be a teacher for the rest of my life.
Eventually, Clemens couldn't make the numbers work. She now works on policy and programs related to children and families. But she says that every day she misses the kids and how they learn.
They're like planting all these seeds for themselves, right? And they're learning. And it's just so, it's so cool.
Where's the car coming? This is a car.
At St. Mary's Child Care Center, run by Christine Cook, toddlers sing their ABCs and build important social-emotional skills through play.
ABCD.
Research shows a child's first 5 years are crucial for brain development. What young children learn and experience stays with them for life.
TV.
But childcare professionals say their compensation doesn't match the science. The government does not support childcare in the same way it supports K-12 education, and centers can't afford to pay their teachers more. They have large expenses, and they'd have to charge families higher tuition. Christine Cook and others say society doesn't understand or respect the field enough.
Early childhood is not recognized as something more than just babysitting, taking care of kids for the day.
And right now, childcare providers are paid like babysitters, not like teachers. And until that changes, more teachers will likely leave the profession, and more centers will have to turn families away or shut down altogether. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And for more on this story and others here at Wisconsin Public Radio, visit WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.